Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Blogging Heads Foreign Entanglements. As always, I'm your host, Natalie Sambi. I'm an analyst at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute in Canberra and managing editor of our blog, The Strategist. Today, we'll be discussing Australia's foreign policy challenges. And with me, I have Melissa Connolly-Tyler. She's currently the National Executive Director of the Australian Institute of International Affairs in Canberra. Should also mention that I'm currently Vice President of the ACT branch. But Melissa, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Natalie.
Melissa, you've had a very varied career. Just to introduce yourself to the viewers, I was hoping you could just tell us a little bit about yourself, and I'm hoping that you talk a little bit about the time that you spent in the Bronx as well.
Absolutely. Well, maybe I'm a lesson that there is life after law. I started off as a lawyer and I think of myself as a recovering lawyer. I worked in private practice, worked in government, and then I decided it was time to do something international with my life. I went to the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy in Boston, had a fantastic time, and particularly discovered conflict resolution as the thing that inspires my passion. So I worked a bit with the Harvard Program on Negotiation, and yes, I did go to the Bronx to learn to be a mediator. It's a tough gig. And when I fell for an Australian constitutional lawyer and had to come back home, the Australian Institute of International Affairs has been the perfect place for me, keeping an international focus from an Australian base.
Excellent. And just for a bit of background, can you tell us a little bit about what the AAA does? That's the Institute.
Yeah, so we're part of, I suppose, a network worldwide of institutes whose job is to promote public understanding and interest in international affairs. We originally established as a branch of Chatham House about the same time as the Council on Foreign Relations. We operate all around Australia. We have seven states and territory branches, and we have about 200 events a year at the moment trying to educate Australians on international issues. We publish the Australian Journal of International Affairs, and we have a very popular blog called Australian Outlook. So any of your viewers who are interested in writing, just get in contact.
Absolutely. And look, just, congratulations, I have to say, because AAA took out the top spot in global rankings for think tanks in Southeast Asia and the Pacific. I mean, but this comes to a more important point, I think. I just wanted to ask your opinion. What is really the role of think tanks when it comes to Australian foreign policy and Asia Pacific foreign policy, do you think?
Look, it's a really contested area. We did get congratulations for doing so well in the index, but we also got a lot of people writing to us asking why should think tanks exist? Why should think tankers exist? One of them was suggesting that perhaps we needed to be in tanks filled with water. I understood the comments field. I think they could, think tanks at their best should be a bridge between research and the world of policy. If we look at the work, excellent work that's done around the world in academia, it almost never finds its way into the hands of policymakers for a whole range of reasons. They have different timeframes, they have different cultures, they talk different languages. There's real constraints on good quality research work making its way into informing policymakers' views. Bridge institutions like think tanks can play a very useful role there in trying to somewhat interpret the results, in trying to provide conduits for good quality thinking to get into policymaker space. I think the issue comes when there are things that are termed think tanks, which are probably more PR or lobbying when you come down to it. Sure. So for me, I think there are three I's that I would talk about. We have to, think tanks have to think very much about their influence, and they should try and be influential if they're doing the job well. They don't want to, you know, be so pure that they don't influence anybody. They also have to think about their independence, and if they do not have genuine independence of thought, then they're not doing the job well. And lastly, I think about integrity. That it's about, even if you have, say, an ideological view, which my institute does not, you have to be very, very clear about the way you've gone about research, how it's been funded. In some ways, I think the ranking I'm more proud of for the Australian Institute of International Affairs is that we're the only think tank in Australia or New Zealand that's rated as fully transparent by Transverify. And I think that's about keeping your integrity as an organisation.
Sure. I should also probably highlight that it's a different landscape, I think, for think tanks in Australia than there is, for instance, when you compare something like DC, We've got a different group of institutes down here in Australia. Just looking more broadly to Australia's international affairs, how would you characterise Australia's foreign policy? And in your opinion, what should we be directing our efforts towards?
Yeah, the interesting thing for Australia is in some ways we're quite promiscuous. We look at lots of areas of the world. There are some countries where I think their relationships with the world are primarily seen through a particular prism, you know, the threatening neighbour that you're always worried about, or the hated former colonial overlord. And that becomes, you know, that takes up most of the field of vision that those countries look at when they look at foreign policy. In Australia's case, we're not unidirectional. We look at lots of things. So clearly we care about what's happening in the US. We also care about Asia, our region, the region that is so much a part of our prosperity. We still care about what's happening in Europe through ties of history. We have a strong interest, I'm not really sure why, in the Middle East, but everybody does. And we have increasing interests in what's happening in Latin America and Africa, which have been less a part of the Australian foreign policy space, but have been growing partly through diaspora populations and through business opportunities. I think if I'm looking at the map, probably the only bit we haven't traditionally looked at much is somewhere like Central Asia, but that can change when you have long wars in the period. So in that sense, Australia looks around the world broadly. We think that what happens in the world affects us. And so our foreign policy is I think, a multidimensional one. Now, that said, Asia Pacific is always going to be a key part of what we do and what we have to think about. And from Australia's perspective, that's where the big questions, the big existential questions are. Can we preserve our wonderful economic relationship with a rising China and our long-term security relationship with the US? Are there things about changes in the Asia Pacific that's going to make the balancing act that we've traditionally followed more difficult for us? Those are things that we obviously focus a lot on.
Of course, I'm going to have to go for the obvious issue here. With looking at the Asia Pacific, we always end up talking about China. And I just wanted to get your take on what some of the challenges are that, from Australia's perspective, we see in the Asia Pacific with China, not only its rise, but perhaps its more assertive behaviour in certain areas.
Absolutely. And you know, that's the big question on everyone's lips, is what sort of international actor will China be? My view is that it's too early to tell, in a way. I am probably on the less alarmist part of Australian opinion at the moment. There's a real schism in the way that Australia is seeing China. In terms of the security and defence community, they are very concerned, no question about it. And I think the tone of debate has hardened a lot, even in just the last couple of years. So China's more assertive behaviour is absolutely causing concern to the security and defence community. But if you look at the business community, they see opportunity. If you look at public opinion in general, is actually very positive towards China. So you can look at, say, Lowy Institute polling on how warmly Australians feel towards China, and really is quite good in many ways. Linda Jacobsen is being almost quite schizophrenic in the way that there are quite different communities who have quite different views of China. And the question is going to be who's right on that. If I look at the challenge that China faces for the Asia Pacific, I think it's not yet clear what sort of threat it is to order in the Asia Pacific. And I suppose I'm contrasting that, say, with Russia's threat to international order. We had some wonderful visitors from Poland recently, and, you know, they really are looking at something quite different there. Invading a neighbour and annexing territory is one thing. Arguing hard over territorial disputes over rocks, it's another thing, you know. And it's not clear to me as yet that China's assertive behaviour has gone outside what we might see with any territorial dispute. So, for example, the US and Canada have territorial disputes over the Arctic, and we don't presume that that is going to be some threat to international order. So I'm probably in the side of the voice of caution on presuming that we're seeing a challenge in what I've seen so far.
I mean, I guess I wanted to tease that out because I've often seen somewhere that Australia perhaps isn't doing enough, you know, to resist some of the things that China has done, and that our seeming ambivalence is almost tantamount to appeasement sometimes. And some of those views tend to emanate from our alliance partners. So I just wanted to get a sense from you, is there a role for us to play, given that we do have this relationship on the one hand where we want to encourage business and economic opportunities, but anxiety and concern on the other about the behaviour?
Look, I'm not sure if we should be playing a role, but I think, in fact, we are, and there's no choice in the matter. I think from Australia's perspective, we'd probably be very happy sometimes just being left out of it. We used to have a lot less salience in international affairs. It was a much more comfortable place to be. These days, I think Australia's looked at much more as a weather vane, because so many other countries in the Asia Pacific are dealing with exactly the same issues, whether that's South Korea or Thailand or Philippines. We all have the same sort of issues that we're trying to balance. And so Australia's choices become much more interesting to everybody else, which puts you in a rather exposed position. So suddenly every small decision that is made is some sort of signalling about how this fight, conflict, undeclared conflict between the US and China is progressing. And that's a very uncomfortable place for Australia to be. So given that, one should try to use that position for good rather than ill and try and see what can be done to smooth over some issues where they do not need to be escalated.
I mean, obviously taking the other big relationship Australia shares globally, and that's our alliance, I know that you know, having looked at Australian Outlook, your blog, there was a post not that long ago by one of our members that advocated that Australia perhaps step away from the alliance, and which might be a viewpoint that claims is quite a shock to a lot of people. I mean, Melissa, what do you think about that? That's quite a really provocative statement to make. Is our alliance worth it?
Look, I would say that in terms of where opinion is in Australia at the moment, the vast majority of the opinion is that the US alliance is the bedrock of Australian security and is essentially sacrosanct. So that is the majority opinion, that is the elite opinion, that is where we're at. There are more voices now talking about the costs of the alliance. And I think if you're looking at the costs and benefits of the alliance, you have to look at them in two planes. So we think about what are the costs and benefits now and what are the costs and benefits into the future. Okay. So if you're doing that sort of calculus, you say, well, you know, what are the benefits now? Intelligence sharing, for example. People talk about Five Eyes and how delightful that is. That seems to go down a little bit when we have things like the invasion of Iraq, where we think, yeah, maybe that wasn't all it was cracked up to be. But in general, you know, there are some real benefits. In terms of cost, there are costs too. There are costs too in terms of procurement and how we are seen by the region. So there are certainly some in, say, Indonesia or in India who would see Australia as a compliant ally which lacks full independence in international affairs. So, you know, that is a cost for us. But then those are outweighed by looking at, well, what are the costs and benefits in the future if we need it? And that's where the insurance policy understanding of the alliance comes in. I've been on the Australian-American Leadership Dialogue, and I can tell you that the experience of going and seeing PACOM in action, you know, that does actually change your view on what this means. We can worry in Australia about whether American public opinion would ever come to our aid, as it were. It would be a decision at the time if we ever had to call on that guarantee, and we can worry a lot about it. But at the same time, you know, we hope the treaty commitments would be honoured. That's the debate that's had, and that's in people's minds. I don't think at this point that the concerns about the costs of the alliance have moved into the mainstream thinking. I think that is bedrock at the moment, but there are perhaps more voices asking some of those questions.
I mean, in terms of insurance policy, I just wanted to tease out a little bit more about Australia's relationships perhaps with other Asia Pacific states. I'm thinking here obviously India and Japan. There's been a lot of talk lately about Australia perhaps growing even closer to Japan with the potential Japanese build of our submarines, but also Prime Minister Abe using the A word to describe Australia as an ally. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about the kinds of relationships that we enjoy with Japan and India, and is there any potential as democratic middle powers in those relationships?
I think they're very complex relationships in a range of ways. I think people can be surprised sometimes by what a positive relationship Australia has with Japan. Colleagues in China have been very surprised at some of the positive things that Australia is willing to say about Japan. And you can see a sort of depth of reconciliation following the events of 70 years ago that have not been true for a lot of Southeast Asia and North Asia. So broadly, Australians are extremely positive about Japan. My issue is how far Japan should be relying on that to assume that we have an exact identity of interests. I don't think we do. I think because Australia also has no problems with China, we have a very positive attitude towards China, and we see our economic relationship benefiting both parties greatly. I'm not sure that we would go as far as Japan on all the issues that Japan would progress. And I feel a bit the same with India. I think at times we get talked about as a potential trilateral or quadrilateral grouping as if we have exactly the same interests, but I'm not sure that we do on all fronts. There's a lot of interest in increasing those relationships. For example, the Australian Institute of International Affairs is holding a trilateral dialogue with the Japan Institute of International Affairs and the Indian Council of World Affairs. So there's a lot of interest in doing more in that space. But one of the notes of caution I'll be putting there is let's not assume we all want exactly the same things. There's an overlap in our interests, but not an identity.
So, I mean, looking at other relationships in the region as well, you mentioned Indonesia earlier, and we have an up and down relationship. Where do you think the relationship's at right now with our closest neighbour?
Up and down might be a little polite. It might be down and more down sometimes. I remember we held a dialogue with some Indonesian colleagues, and the discussion was had that you want to have the snake in the pipe, if you can imagine. So the relationship will go up and down, like a snake going up and down, but you want to keep it within some sort of bounds. You want the pipe that you can keep it in. I feel like the pipe's subterranean at the moment, but that's me. I think it's a very difficult area, and it's one that's going to take a long time for the relationship to improve greatly. There has been traditionally a very strong government-to-government relationship under SBY. That was wonderful for Australia. Things are harder now. But at the people-to-people level, it's extremely challenging. We find that any small issue can be magnified greatly. And I think that shows the lack of ballast in the relationship. So it's a long, slow road, would be my approach, and we hope that things continue to improve. On the positive side, my argument would be that for both Indonesia and Australia, we can have so much more weight in the international system if we work together. And you can see this through some of the things that we've done together in G20, for example. We potentially help each other a lot, but getting to the point where we can see that is more difficult.
There's another grouping that Indonesia and Australia also belong to, that's MICTA. You know, there are a couple of activities every now and then. Not many people really know much about MICTA, which is, I mean, as I like to call it, everyone other than a great power, but then more than a small developing state as well. And they seem to be a group of quite dynamic countries. What's your take on MICTA? Does it have any kind of utility?
I think it's potentially very interesting. So if you think of it as the middle powers' answer to the BRICS, you know, Mexico, Indonesia, Turkey, South Korea and Australia, we're in about the same space in the international system. We're G20 members, we have open economies, we're trade-focused, we'd say we all have strong democracy. You can go through a number of factors. The question is not about the like-mindedness. I would actually say that MICTA countries work better together than, say, BRICS, which I think have real issues of cohesion. The issue is what should MICTA do? It's a very logical group and it works very well, but what's its job as yet? And that's been the question that I think has been raised but not quite yet answered for me. So the communiques coming out of each of the MICTA meetings have had, I think, a great list of things we could do together, and the question is going to be, which of them do we choose to operationalise? Which of them is enough of a common interest in all of the MICTA members that we can work together to actually achieve something in the international sphere? If we do that well, then it'll be showing the potential power of middle power groupings.
If you could pick anything out of those communiques for MICTA, if you had a wish list, what would you put on it? I mean, given that Indonesia and Australia are there, and you said earlier that we could do more things together, you know, what could some of those things be?
I think it's a really small list at the moment. If you look at some, say nuclear non-proliferation, some of the states are very keen on this, others less so. If you look at environmental issues, which is another area we could all work together on, some countries are very keen, but others perhaps less so. And so trying to find a topic for niche diplomacy where we think those countries all have an interest and can work together is, I think, a little more difficult, we might think. In some ways, though, there's been some good signs on the informal people-to-people side. So there's starting to be various dialogues for non-official dialogues for various groupings, academics, young people, you know, mid-career people coming from the MICTA countries and starting to work together. In some ways, that's been the most exciting part of the BRICS, I think, the sense that there's a sort of peer-to-peer discussion among the BRICS. And if something similar could be happening in MICTA, that would give it a lot more interest, even if we can't find that one big issue at the international level to work on right yet.
So we were talking just a second ago about Australia-Indonesia relations and the potential for us to work together in the context of MICTA. I'd like to just look ahead at some of the things that might be even more challenging to us in future. And here I'd like to talk a little bit about development aid. So with our new government, there came a consolidation of some of the activities that we were doing overseas, and we merged our Australian Development Aid Agency, AusAid, back into our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. What impact do you think our cuts, or what impact do you think that had for a second? And second, you know, cutting our aid budget, is that going, what sort of impact do you think that's had on our relationships with countries like Indonesia?
Well, these are difficult issues. In terms of the integration itself, I think that was probably somewhat expected. If you look at what had happened in Canada and New Zealand, I think there's a sense that from the conservative side of politics, that aid should be better integrated with foreign policy and trade. And I think that was not in itself a surprise. The integration process, of course, is, you know, somewhat difficult, as it is for any organisations. If you talk about corporate mergers, for example, they're difficult things. My feeling is that newly integrated DFAT is actually coming to the end of that tunnel, as it were. That the sort of, you know, the difficult period of bedding down those changes is probably towards an end. And I'm one of the optimists that I think in the longer term, having the mix of aid and foreign affairs voices can actually make the department stronger. The aid cuts potentially hurt us internationally, no question about that. The first set of aid cuts, I think, again, was not unexpected. The second set and the second budget, I think, was unexpected and was taken very, very badly by the sector here, and I think was probably noticed negatively internationally. And so the long-term question will be, will there be a consensus again towards getting up 2.7, which is the internationally accepted benchmark for where we'd like to be. We had bipartisan consensus on that issue. That's broken down at the moment. Can we build it up again? And I know the people who are pushing on this issue do look to other governments and to other conservative governments. So if they look at, Cameron government in the UK, where there, even in the face of austerity, there was a commitment to maintaining aid. That's the sort of debate that those people want to have in Australia.
I mean, what do you say to critics who say that actually, look, this is a good thing? I mean, supporters of the aid cuts in our government, for instance, you say, look, by cutting our aid, we're actually letting our neighbours stand on their own 2 feet. We're actually acknowledging that they don't need to be recipients of aid, which may inherently be an asymmetrical power relationship.
I think we're talking about different things there. Absolutely, we may be saying that Indonesia was one of our largest aid recipients. Maybe that was no longer appropriate. Indonesia very soon is going to have a bigger economy than the Australian economy. Maybe we've moved beyond that in our relationship. Absolutely. But I think what I'd be saying is that the international standard of trying to get to the, you know, the 0.7, that's quite distinct from where you spend that money. You know, we may decide that the best way to spend that money is on Australian volunteers going around the world. It may be on educational programs to bring the best and brightest to Australia. It may be on, you know, climate change adaptation. Those are questions you then have to decide. But I think in terms of the standard, that's what Australia, I think, has been criticised for, not keeping to that.
And last question for today, I'd just like to talk a little bit about the practice of foreign affairs in this country. I know that you've written before that you question the idea that international relations is too hard, international affairs is too hard for women. I mean, why on earth does that view exist, and what can we do to address that kind of perception?
Yeah, look, that's coming off some debates that have happened in the blogosphere in Australia over recent years.
I mean, can I just say for a second, I'm astounded that we're having this conversation nevertheless. But
that we are still having this. When people try to explain why are women still underrepresented in international affairs, they look at France as, okay, and the underrepresentation is still clear. There is no question about it. You can look at the senior echelons of diplomats, academia, international organisations and say women are not represented at the level that you would expect them to be over population, and particularly given that there has been very strong recruitment of women for a long time. So, for example, in our Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, I think it's from the mid-80s, we've had equal recruitment of men and women. So you would expect, ideally, those people to then have been progressing to senior ranks. So you then have to ask yourself why. What's going wrong with that pipeline? Why aren't people moving through it as much as we might otherwise expect? Some of the answers people might give might be that women aren't interested in some of this. And so that's where that idea of being hard comes from, that women aren't interested in hard security issues. And no, you would not agree with that. Sometimes people bring up the idea that it's personal preference. I would be saying that looking at the underrepresentation of women in Australia's international affairs, I see four factors. There is still a legacy of the direct discrimination that women suffered. That doesn't exist in the same way anymore, but it does have legacy effects. You can see indirect discrimination in the sense of the way the workplace is organised, patronage networks, mentoring opportunities. There's clearly the impact of family responsibilities, and that still tends to be a differential impact in that women take on more of the family responsibilities in many cases in most countries. And then finally, I think there are some gendered assumptions about what international affairs is, and this is the other idea of being too hard, that hard security issues are sometimes seen as more men's business. So I know Alison Brunowski talks about this as being a glass curtain rather than a glass ceiling, that security issues are seen as more naturally masculine in some way, whereas human rights, public diplomacy, they're all more on the feminine side. And so there can be a sense that through unconscious bias, women aren't given the same opportunities in some of the things that are perceived culturally as more masculine.
Well, I mean, I guess one of the ways I see us addressing that is about creating more space. So hopefully, you know, the work that you and I do and the space that's created by places like Australian Outlook and other kinds of blogs will help address that over time.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. Melissa, thanks very much for your overview of Australian foreign policy today and sharing your candid views. Thank you so much again for your time.
Thank you again, Natalie. It's been a pleasure.